corporations started on the backs of an internet that all of us paid for, American taxpayers, and use our roads, our infrastructures without paying taxes. So what we need are economic rights. We need personal rights so we control what is datafied about us. We need to ask big questions about what should not be datafied and what should not be in the hands of these shady corporations, recognizing that our data are bought and sold, and that can be very, very much a violation of a free competition. We've seen a lot of Federal Trade Commission acts. And basically what this is being doing is to wield us. It's influencing our behavior. It's influencing our lives. It's constructing our consumption. It's even constructing our sense of desire. And as we've talked about, it's reinforcing discrimination through discriminatory algorithms and discriminatory practices. So what we need are rights-based legislation that are not just about individual rights or privacy, but really bleed into the question of the economic rights we all have and need to have around the planet in our digital lives.
We want to thank you so much for being with us, Ramesh Srinivasan, professor of information studies at UCLA, host of the podcast Utopias, author of Beyond the Valley, speaking to us from Oaxaca, Mexico. A hilarious side note is so many young people were calling into Congress saying, what's Congress? What's a senator? Because TikTok said they should call. I'm Amy Goodman with Nurin Mainsheikh.
You're listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM.
KBOO's All Thrills, No Frills special programming campaign is almost over. So to listen to all of our thrilling specials from this drive, just go to kboo.fm/thrills. We invite you to become a member right now by going to kboo.fm/give or by texting KBOO to 44321. Contribute during this last week of the drive and help us reach our $22,000 goal. Hurry and join the KBOO family today.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operation and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communication Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Policy and Governance Committee meets on the third Tuesday of March, June, September, and December at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, an Oregon pharmacy's owner is among those gathering on Capitol Hill today demanding reform for a system she says threatens her patients. City and county leaders say they're crafting a new plan to help more people out of houselessness. And an effort to save marine mammals like sea lions off our west coast is underway. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, March 14th, 2024. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. An Oregon U.S. Senator drew a crowd of supporters on Capitol Hill today to push for reform in a system that many of us rely on for life-saving medications. Here's part of what Senator Ron Wyden said about the problem.
We are going to use every single opportunity to make sure that the patients and the pharmacists finally get a fair shake. And this is not a complicated issue, folks. This is about the fact that two United States senators believe that we ought to be helping patients and pharmacists and taxpayers rather than these PBMs that are hijacking their money. As far as we're concerned, the time for meaningful PBM reform for all of you was actually yesterday. We have been fighting this battle for too long. These middlemen have been pricing life-saving medicines out of reach for patients that need them for one reason. They can pad their profits, and we're here to say those days are going to end.
Yeah.
These harmful PBM policies make it harder for patients to serve their pharmacies, to serve their patients, especially in rural communities like in my home state. Where's Michelle Belcher? Michelle is from Grants Pass, Oregon. And she is a textbook case of a pharmacist who's a role model. During, she was actually helping patients do their paperwork. She's there for every good cause in the community. And the reason we're here today, and all these wonderful folks in white coats are here, is because we believe political change isn't really top down. It's really grassroots up. And now all these pharmacists are speaking out and helping seniors and helping taxpayers. And we believe on the Senate Finance Committee that with our bill, it was a very narrow vote, very narrow, 26 to nothing. The Senate Finance Committee on a bipartisan basis isn't backing down today, tomorrow, or ever until we finally get PBM reform in America to help pharmacists and patients.
Yeah.
We want to put patients over profits and pass PBM reforms into law.
And after Oregon U.S. Senator Ron Wyden spoke, he got some support from the owner of an Oregon pharmacy on Capitol Hill.
I'm Michelle Belcher, owner of Grants Pass Pharmacy in Grants Pass, Oregon. I am also past president of the National Community Pharmacists Association, and I am a grateful constituent of Senator Ron Wyden, whom I met on an airplane many years ago. I'm sure I spoiled his flight by bending his ear on how PBMs were making it difficult for community pharmacies to stay in business and serve their patients. Since then, Senator Wyden has visited my store many times. No one has worked harder to understand our business and our patients, to educate the public and his colleagues in Congress, and to fight for the changes we and our patients need. I would also like to thank Senator Crapo. Like Senator Wyden, he's been a true champion for community pharmacies. He and Senator Wyden make a dynamic duo, and I think it's because they come from states where the local pharmacy is the only healthcare provider around for many people. I come from one of those places. My patients are my neighbors. I grew up with many of them. I knew their parents when my dad was their local pharmacist. We went to school and to church together. I've been taking care of them and seeing them as they grow, attending their weddings, watching their children be born, helping them when their children are sick, and with their sick and aging parents. What I resent most about the PBMs is that they make it harder for me to care for the people I care about most. I have a patient who has been coming to our store since my dad was behind the counter. She's 84 years old and widowed. Her kids moved out of the area some time ago, so they rely on us to check up on their mom when we delivered her medications that are specially packaged for her. Her daughter called me not long ago and said, Mom's PBM is trying to force her to mail order by charging her more to go to your pharmacy. She'll get medicine, but she won't get health care. Her daughter said that without us, her mom would be forced into moving into a assisted living facility. Heartbreaking. If her life isn't in a facility, it's in her home with all the memories. I have another patient who doesn't have a home. He's been living in shelters and on the street. A doctor who treated him called me and asked if we carried a particular insulin. We did, and we filled that prescription. He had previously been to three other pharmacies and had no luck getting this prescription filled. When we filled that prescription, we lost $150. That means the PBM paid us $150 below the cost to purchase that medication. In January and February alone, my pharmacy filled over 200 prescriptions for different and were paid more than $5,000 below our invoice cost. If I continue to be paid below my cost, I will be forced to close my doors. Last year, Oregon had 37 pharmacies that permanently closed, and two so far this year. I can't keep helping these people, my friends and neighbors, if I can't stay in business. And if PBMs get their way, and I keep losing money, and my patients are herded off to mail order pharmacies, I will have to close so many other community pharmacies. Some of my patients may still take their medicines via the mail, but medicine isn't healthcare. Healthcare is knowing your patients and asking them questions. How are you feeling today, Mrs. Jones? What other medications are you taking? Have you eaten today? Are you taking your medicine correctly? Did you know that you're past due for this vaccine? Let's sit down and take your blood pressure today. Can we talk about your diet and exercise so maybe you won't get diabetes? Without PBM reform, independent pharmacies like mine will close.
Michelle Belcher is the owner of Grants Pass Pharmacy in Oregon. And the state of Oregon, along with Multnomah County and Portland City leaders, announced this week they're crafting a new plan to target another big issue impacting our community, houselessness. At a special session with Portland leaders, Multnomah County Chair Jessica Vega Peterson talked about the problems and the plan to try to solve them.
Homelessness is one of our most pressing, complex, and challenging issues facing our country, our state, and our community. It is heartbreaking, devastating, and all too common. It is a humanitarian crisis, and it's a crisis that has been decades in the making. Federal disinvestment in housing, economic instability, rising prices and inflation, persistent racial inequalities in access to care and housing, and too little mental health support, and the impacts of the pandemic have created a crisis of historic proportions. We all see and feel this every day on our streets. I've seen the same things you have, a dramatic increase in the human beings who don't have a safe and stable place to call home. It impacts thousands of people in every single neighborhood. I've seen examples in my own neighborhood of Hazelwood. There have been multiple RVs parked along my streets or pitched in the medians near my house. Some of the folks living this way provide homework help to their kids on a makeshift RV table. They're waking up in a tent and trying to get to their doctor's appointment on time. They're trying to find recovery. They're someone's child or parent. In these moments, I know that our systems are not working properly to address the crisis that they're in. And it can't if things don't change. When I became chair, I knew we had to immediately begin developing a coordinated effort, one that would tackle this problem at its root. We needed to involve providers, people with lived experience, and the many advocates who have been working on this issue for years. We are not starting this work from scratch. We are expanding on what's come before and what's worked. We are letting go of what hasn't worked, and we're moving forward. Our homelessness response action plan includes three things I know will help us deliver. One, bold goals and clear outcomes for the next several years. Two, a coordinated approach that makes homelessness the priority it must be across a complex system. Three, accountability and measurement of our current efforts. Key metrics to assess the work and better data collecting and track. We now finally have a comprehensive count of people experiencing homelessness in our community. We know many of their names. We know that there are 11,153 people without a home in Multnomah County in January of 2020. We know about 29% were sleeping night to night on couches, in shelters, or other temporary situations. Nearly 5,400 were sleeping outside or otherwise without shelter. This baseline gives us a starting place to measure all the work before us. It also helps us set clear goals. The first of these goals, shelter house 2,700 more people by the end of 2025. This cuts the number of people sleeping outside last January by half. One way we'll do this is by adding 1,000 shelter beds to our resources within 2 years. This new community sheltering strategy has been developed by Portland, Gresham, Multnomah County, and a range of shelter operators. The shelter strategy also cards for hundreds of new behavioral health beds for stabilization, residential treatment, and substance use. It includes a drop-off sobering center. We'll redefine what it looks like to leave a shelter successfully by increasing the number of people who exit with a housing plan by 15%. We'll focus on the true aim of this work, keeping people in permanent housing once they get there. You'll see specific priority for some of the most vulnerable people living in our streets, especially people of color and those who identify as LGBTQIA2S+. These are people often hit hardest and longest by homelessness and are more likely to become victims of violent crime. We need to reverse these trends as quickly as possible. In order for us to do this work successfully, we must also address critical points in the system where we know people become homeless. You'll see a preventative focus. That means not releasing people from our systems into homelessness, stopping the inhumane practice of releasing people from hospital, treatment, or jail directly to the streets to fend for themselves without the resources they need. We'll work in partnership to increase the supply of affordable housing through regulatory changes, building conversions, and new construction funding. It is time for everyone in a leadership role to work together. Next, we build on that collaboration that went into creating this plan by asking the community to help us pressure test and finalize it through information and feedback sessions over the next few weeks. One question everyone is asking is, what's different about this plan? Why will this plan succeed? We've come a very long way in the development of our systems in recent years. We've tripled shelter capacity. We've been on a path of continuous process improvement. We've invited more people to the table than ever before. We're building up the strongest parts of our systems to meet the need and creating a level playing field for the resources every shelter provider needs to be successful. We're doing this because it's an emergency, which is why we need every single shelter bed we currently have.
That was Multnomah County Chair Jessica Vega Peterson. And joining her at the special county city work session on houselessness was Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler.
The homeless crisis is the number one issue facing Portlanders and beyond. And we have responded. This is not the beginning point. This is a continuation of the efforts that we've already undertaken. During my time as mayor, I have watched as our city council has literally reinvented local government to address the homeless crisis. We've shifted dollars, we've created and funded new programs, we've developed new partnerships. We established the task sites, the SRV sites, associated services, created hundreds upon hundreds of new full-service shelter beds. We significantly increased the impact reduction program. We created the Portland Office of Environmental Management. We launched the Portland Street Response Program. We did the 90-day resets. We did 5 emergency declarations to move the work more expeditiously. And now we're working on Portland Solutions to move some of our programming citywide. It has been completely changing to our government, and we've been moving with urgency. Whether it's through messages through from constituents, public meetings, or direct feedback from outreach staff, first responders, and public health workers that interact directly with the most vulnerable individuals on our street, we know that we have a lot of work to do, and we're coming together to fix it. Any of our homeless strategies have to be guided by data, by fact. I'm pleased that this plan does that. The Homeless Response Action Plan that we're discussing is a commitment to fundamentally transform our approach to homelessness in the city of Portland and to do it together. This is the first time a plan will provide a unified strategy that sets specific and achievable goals while covering critical areas previously neglected, including the important behavioral health component. I think the plan's distinctiveness lies in its clarity as well as its accountability. It sets forth explicit goals, timelines, and responsible entities, and it ensures that our efforts are concerted and that our progress is completely trackable, both by us as well as the community at large. It's more transparent, it is more data-informed. At the center of the plan is an ambitious goal. The goal is to halve unsheltered homelessness by the end of 2025. That is ambitious. It is a true call to action. And I believe that we collectively, with this plan, assuming it is implemented properly, can achieve that goal. The homeless struggle in our community is probably the thorniest social issue local elected officials have ever had to deal with because it is so multifaceted. It's about poverty, it's about behavioral health, it's about addiction, it's about unemployment, it's about broader economic trends. Let's just be honest, 10 years ago was not set up for the kinds of issues that we are seeing on our streets. So we have had to work together to reinvent government. And the whole while, people will still throw the slings and arrows at us because they see the manifestations of this multifaceted crisis on their streets. And they hold us accountable for the streets. But any of us who have served any amount of time working on this issue know that there are upstream systems that have already failed that lead to these problems on our streets in the first place. So we will do our part here, and we will do it excellently, and we will push our efforts up the political food chain, if you will, so that if we do our work right here, we can start to see the changes taking place at the state level.
Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In Depth. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, American Indian Airwaves. Tonight's weather will see mainly clear skies, low down to 38. Tomorrow's weather, beautiful, sunny, up to 67. Today in history, on this date in 1879, Albert Einstein was born. His theories of special and general relativity drastically altered the human understanding of the universe. Our quote of the day is from Einstein, who said, "Learn from yesterday, live for today, hope for tomorrow. The important thing is not to stop questioning." The Washington State Legislature made investments in programs to improve child care in the state. However, as Eric Tegedov reports, advocates say lawmakers need to do much more to make care accessible for everyone.
Advocates for accessible child care saw wins during Washington State's legislative session this year, but still see room for improvement. Lawmakers invested in a number of programs that increase funding for child care providers. Genevieve Stokes with Child Care Aware of Washington says the state is building a foundation for universal access for families.
The investments this year were modest, but still really tackled some of the crucial things that we were hoping they would look at.
Some of the investments include $1.75 million for free infant and early childhood mental health consultations, more than $8 million for the Early Childhood Education and Assistance Program, and nearly $7 million in additional grant money for capital improvements for early learning facilities. However, Stokes says gaps remain.
The funding this year and the funding so far doesn't address the child care crisis for middle-income families, and it doesn't solve the issue of child care providers not being able to make a living wage.
Stokes says not finding care puts parents in a bind and impacts the economy.
When parents can't find child care or can't afford child care, they can't work, and then they're faced with impossible choices with few good outcomes.
I'm Eric Tegedoff.
California lawmakers are trying to change the rules about fishing gillnets, which injure many species, including sea lions. Suzanne Potter reports on a bill aiming to reduce marine mammal entanglements.
A new bill aims to reduce the number of sea lions, sharks, rays, skates, and giant sea bass that are dying off the coast of Southern California in huge set gillnets the size of 20 football fields weighted to the seafloor. Right now, set gillnets are banned in most state waters, and Assembly Bill 2220 would extend that ban to a 3-mile radius around the Channel Islands. Caitlin Birch with the nonprofit Oceana says the bill also stops crews from profiting off of certain species accidentally caught in the nets.
It will remove the exemption that allows set gillnet fisheries to incidentally catch and sell great white sharks and giant sea bass, which are both protected species in California currently, and not allowed for take commercially or recreationally for any other fisheries in California.
Opponents cite concerns about the impact on fishing crews' bottom line. About 30 fishermen still have active set gillnet permits in Southern California. The state has stopped issuing new permits, and this bill would make existing ones non-transferable. The bill would also give the California Department of Fish and Wildlife the authority to require independent monitors on fishing boats, but would not make them mandatory. Right now, it's up to fishing crews to self-report when they accidentally catch a protected species.
Having the authority to place third-party observers on vessels would allow for the collection of unbiased data on specifically bycatch, which is being thrown overboard at sea and isn't otherwise able to be tracked.
Supporters contend that more selective hook-and-line fishing methods have significantly less bycatch and typically yield higher prices for fish considered better quality seafood. I'm Suzanne Potter.
Former President Trump gets some charges dismissed in the Georgia election interference case. Republicans reinvestigate law enforcement's response to the January 6th incident, and the RNC seeks poll watchers for its new election integrity division. For more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2024 Talks.
So what are we going to do here, folks? I only need 11,000 votes. Fellas, I need 11,000 votes. Give me a break.
Former President Donald Trump's call to Georgia's Secretary of State pressuring him to find votes in 2020 helped lay the groundwork for a sprawling election interference case. The judge dismissed some of the charges against him, including whether he asked officials to violate their oaths of office. The charges could be narrowed and filed again, and Trump still faces 10 other counts there. House Republicans have reopened an investigation of the January 6th Capitol riot, questioning law enforcement's failure to detect pipe bombs left outside National Party offices. But Democratic Representative Norma Torres of California says public hearings could undermine the FBI's ongoing investigation.
This isn't an episode of CSI or Law and Order. We don't get to write our own ending according to what may or may not be convenient for our politics.
The House has passed a bill banning the popular video app TikTok if its Chinese owners don't sell their stake, which some call a national security threat. The bill now goes to the Senate. Newly installed RNC co-chair Laura Trump says the party is seeking volunteer poll watchers for its new election integrity division. Ballot fraud is extremely rare, but Trump insists protecting the vote is their top priority.
To anyone out there who is thinking about cheating in an election, we will go after you. You will be prosecuted to the full extent of the law. It is not worth it.
The former president has made repeated unproven charges about ballot collection programs, but his daughter-in-law says the RNC has now launched what she calls a legal ballot harvesting operation, run by an election denier and former Trump attorney. With a new liberal majority, the Wisconsin Supreme Court will reconsider a previous decision banning ballot drop boxes. The court could overturn a 2022 ruling that only the voters themselves can use them, and only at county election offices. Democratic Governor Maura Healey plans to pardon tens of thousands convicted of marijuana possession, which disproportionately impacts people of color. Healey says Massachusetts will be the first state, but she encourages others to do the same.
We believe that this is the most sweeping cannabis pardon ever proposed by any governor in the United States.
4 years after Louisville police shot and killed Breonna Taylor, new federal legislation aims to ban no-knock warrants. Taylor, an unarmed black woman, died when seven plainclothes officers broke into her apartment unannounced. Her mother, Tamika Palmer, calls the bill the right way to commemorate her daughter's murder.
I'm so grateful to have people in the room who continue to understand how important that what happened to Breonna never happens again.
I'm Catherine Carley.
Women leaders take the stage at Res 2024. And the Arctic Winter Games returns to Alaska with global athletes. For those stories and more, here's today's edition of National Native News.
Native women are a key part of the business world, and women leadership was discussed this week at the Reservation Economic Summit in Las Vegas. The event is put together by the National Center for American Indian Enterprise Development. Jan Tiger is a travel attorney and has a business called Show Nation. When it comes to women-led businesses, Tiger says women bring something different, including a different mindset than their male counterparts. And also, she says Native women are often the breadwinners for their families.
Sometimes they're the main person in their family that's providing an income. And it's not always just because they're a single mother, it's just because of circumstances. Sometimes they're the ones that are providing the money for the family and for their, and even outside of their immediate family. A lot of times we're the caregivers for our parents and our siblings and nieces and whoever needs the help, we're charged with that responsibility.
Margot Gray is a board member of the National Center. She wears many hats and has been a part of Res for many years. She says women-led businesses are continuing on the up and up. And when it comes to giving women, especially Indigenous women, advice, she says make sure to have a plan.
Do your homework. You can go to Barnes & Noble or any bookstore and look how to get into business. I'd encourage everyone, if you have that dream, don't overthink it. Do your homework and then be ready to take that risk.
Keynote speakers this week had words of encouragement for attendees like Dakota Lewis, a professional bull rider from Browning, Montana. He says when Indigenous people put their mind to work, they can do powerful things, including Native youth.
You know, dream big, work hard, and just believe in yourself. You know, it's going to be hard at times, but it's going to be worth it. Everybody struggles through things, and just to know that Creator has a plan for all of us and just keep pushing forward. And the only limit is the limit you put on yourself.
More than 4,000 people are gathered together, including tribal leaders, members of Congress, federal agency representatives, state and local officials, and top CEOs to discuss entrepreneurship, business, and mentorship in Indian Country. The summit wraps up Thursday. Competition is heating up at the Arctic Winter Games, an event that many have dubbed as the Olympics of the North. The Matanuska-Susitna Valley near Anchorage is hosting the games this year, the first time the international competition has been in Alaska in a decade. So far, Team Alaska leads the ulu count, medals that are shaped like a native ulu, a carved knife for cutting fish and game. The Yukon and Northwest Territories are in second and third place. Besides the United States, which is represented by Alaska, the Arctic nations include Canada, Greenland, Norway, Sweden, and Finland. The athletes range in age from 11 to 18. At opening ceremonies last weekend, Alfred Tellman, an elder from the Kinnick Tribal Council, welcomed the crowd.
Whether you win or not, you're all winners. Whether you medal or not, you're all winners. You've come a long ways to get here. You've done a lot to be here.
One of the big challenges for Greenland's team was raising the money to travel. But Carl Davidson, who is the Greenlandic government's official representative for the Games, says sports are one way to help young people balance both modern and traditional life.
The sports world in Greenland is very much influenced by the European style. And the Arctic Games are very much less to find in Greenland.
Davidson says Indigenous games like the one-foot high kick have gained popularity in his country, thanks to Greenland's participation in the Arctic Winter Games. The event encompasses a wide range of competitions, from winter sports like figure skating and speed skating to downhill and cross-country skiing. But the Dene Games and other Indigenous sporting events make the Arctic Winter Games a one-of-a-kind event. Alaska Governor Wally Hickel and other Arctic Nation leaders founded the Games in 1959 to bring circumpolar peoples together. The manager of this year's Games, Karen Land, says they will help Alaska build bonds for the future.
It is very special to celebrate that. And the great thing about the Games is that the participants all come and they're strangers, but by the end of the week, they are friends and lifelong friends. And it's just amazing to watch.
The Games run through Saturday. I'm Jill Freitas.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, March 14th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced news.